Okay, so we're recording on Monday, the 26th of November, 2018, at Hull Central Library. Right. I wonder if I could just start by getting you to tell me your name and where and when you were born, just for
yes,
the record.
Yes, my full name is Peter Alton Green. I was born at 11:55 on Tuesday, the 30th of May, 1944. Can you believe that? That's true. Down Albert Avenue in Hull.
So we're here today as part of the Ships in the Sky project to talk mainly about the old Court BHS building and the clubs that yes. are associated with that building. I know you've got a lot of memories relating to that them establishments. I wonder if we could just start by, and I know before we actually started recording, you mentioned this, that you have a memory of that building actually going up. So I wonder if you'd be happy to talk a little bit about the kind of before it was even open and what are your sort of earliest memories of noticing that building or that it was going to be there.
Yeah, I mean, as it happened, I was at school in Scarborough and I lived in Bridlington after that. And then I moved back to Hull in 1962. But I was, because I worked in Hull down Holderness Road, I was well aware of what was going on in Hull because I'm a Hull person. And I saw this building going up, and then, of course, it hit the newspapers that on the top was going to be this ballroom. So I thought, great, because I was already playing guitar, and I was already in bands, you know. I thought, oh, that'd be good, you know, because then there's Tiffany's, which had just opened, or whatever they called it, the Mecca Ballroom. And then there was all the, there was a Majestic down with them, and then there was Kevin Ballroom in the marketplace, and various pubs and clubs around the town. So, you know, you could make quite a bit of extra money. So I was really interested in it. And then, of course, this huge domed roof that was going on. And they said that there was only one other like it in the world, which was in the Kremlin in Moscow, where it pivots on four points and it's concrete. And it took ages. I remember watching it because I was at night school and I could see it from where and I could see this thing going. I thought, when's it going to be finished? When's it going to be finished? And, of course, eventually it was. And it opened. So yeah, I mean, there were a few faults that they had with it. They had a proper dance floor, which is sprung, and we all found that if you went with a gang and started jumping up and down on it, people would fall over because they hadn't got the tension right. When you dance properly, then you need it's like a trampoline effect, but very 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 muted. You just need the extra little push off the floor to get the steps. And, of course, the Skyline was opened as a proper ballroom. So just to put the record straight, the original band in there was not the Sky Sounds. They were never resident there. It was the Skyliners. And I think it was a man called somebody like George Ashton or Ashton or something, and the Skyliners. And they were a proper band. They had a proper rhythm section, piano, bass and drums, and then trumpets and reeds. So it was like All the big dance bands were like that in those days. So, there you go, a little bit of history. Let's put that right. yeah, what next?
So, you mentioned kind of anticipation of this yeah. place opening. Yeah. So, when it finally did open, can you remember your first visit?
Well, I'm just looking at my diary here, and I don't recall going before this, although I may well have done, because I haven't got my 62 diary, but Thursday the 31st of February, of January rather, 63, went to Skyline to see the Vulcans and the Rascals, who were two local bands. I knew them both, and I still know people who were still surviving from those bands. But, it was a lovely hall, actually, because what they'd done is you had that huge ceiling, but before you saw the ceiling, there was a wooden frame with all the lighting and whatever they put on it that was actually suspended off that. I know that because later on I went up there because I had to go up and put some speakers up there for a band I was in. And then there was the main ballroom, and then towards the back there was what they call the beer garden. So if you wanted, you could get a drink in the, I think you could get a drink in the main hall, but if you wanted to just take a rest from that room, you could go into the beer garden, which was very nice, actually. Yeah, it was like a cafe bar. Just let me think. I'm just sort of going through it in my mind. So the main hall had a stage, which you will see on the CD. It's with vertical. It was wooden vertical slats, with a, I seem to think it had a canopy over it, with the main band on. But when groups were on, the main band obviously took their instruments off. And I seem to recall that they would, when they, a little bit later, as we'll come to that, they had a competition, band, you know, group composition. And as we had done very well in the Hull Parks competition in 62, in fact, we won the B group section of that, and then we went to play at the City Hall and we came overall second or third or something, for which we got a week's gig at the Continental Palace, which was a cabaret club on Anderby Road, where the big flats are now. And when we played there, just digressing, we played with an old stagist called Bob and Alf Pearson, who were top of the bill, and they were radio stars from the 50s. So this is the sort of area we were moving in. We were sort of gently moving up a little bit. But back to the Skyline. So with because the groups had their own gear, and they always wanted to use their own gear, their own peer, everything, you know. So they would have one on that stage there and maybe one on that one there. They sort of made an area, because I seem to remember them. On the CD, you'll see a stage, which I believe, as you're looking towards the east, is on the left. But I do recall Scott Madison and the Rangers playing there on the right. So it may have they moved the whole thing. I really can't remember. But that stage did move. one of the problems with that ballroom was having to go up in lift. I mean, there were stairs that you could go up, but most people wanted to use the lift, of course.
Why was that a problem, using the lift?
Well, because there were two lifts, from what I can recall. And the capacity wasn't particularly big, so you ended up in a queue waiting to go up in the lift. But of course, once you got up, it was lovely. Yeah, it was very, very nice. I mean, it was just a marvellous room, really. It was. I can never understand why it never took off quite as well as, say, the Mecca Ballroom. But then that was closer to the centre of town. Don't forget, people didn't have cars in those days, not so many. So people had to get buses and things, and although there's a bus stop outside, it was easy to go into the bus station from the Mecca rather than wait for one from the Skyline, which was probably so the bus would probably be full of the people from the Mecca, you know. all little things interacting with it.
So was you mentioned there then, was it seen as not quite as successful as some of the other kind of venues in the city, or?
Well, how it developed in the 60s was it became a venue for big acts. So, I mean, they had Jimi Hendrix there, they had The Move, they had Traffic. I played a gig there when the Traffic were on. And also that night, there was Chris Fowler and the Thunderbirds, the Mountain Cotton Blues Band, and those which were called The Quadrant then. That was December the 2nd or 3rd, 1967. Hang on, I can even tell you, I wrote it down last night. December the 6th, 1967, that was. And I mean, I saw Eric Clapton there with John Miles Blues Breakers. But I actually didn't go very often as a punter, because I was always working, because I was doing the same job that they were doing. It was amazing what the Move. I don't know whether you remember these people at all, but
I have heard of a lot of them.
Yeah, I mean, that was Roy Wood, who went on to eventually they became Wizard, and then they sort of a spin off that was ELO. I played with The Move at Sheffield University later in the 60s, or maybe the early 70s. They developed it as ballroom dancing seemed to fade a bit. Because the Mecca Ballroom had two bands, and they had a dance band, Gene Mayo or even Ivor Kirchin band, people like that. They had a pop trio that did the breaks, so they got to do three quarters of an hour spot where everybody jived, you know, and then they had to go back to proper dancing again. It was really weird in those days. There were lots of rules, especially rules governing drink. Unless you were a member of a special club at, say, the Mecca Ballroom, you couldn't buy an alcoholic drink. Now, at the co-op, I remember by a beer garden, you can buy beer. So they had a different license. But I think, now I'm thinking about it, I think you had to buy that beer in that room, and if you wanted to. I don't even know if you could take it into the ballroom, quite honestly. I would think you probably can. And plus there were the hours when you could do it. You know, everything had to finish at, say, 10:30. Saturday night was slightly different. Let's say it was 11 o'clock or 11:30. But certainly everything had to finish by midnight, even in hotels everywhere. That was it. Such were the laws of entertainment. So everybody was in, you know, back home in bed for half past 12. There was no problem on the streets after that. Yeah, I'm just trying to think at the back of when I was at Romeo's, when it turned into Romeo's, that's when I reaccessed the beer garden. So we use the old beer garden as a dressing room, or part of it. Yeah, but if I just flip my pages a little bit here. Here we are. So, like, Thursday the 31st, I'd been to see the Vulcans and the Rascals. And then Thursday the 7th of February, 63, went to Skyline to see Scott Maddison and the Rangers and the Barons.
So this is as a punter, as a...
Yeah, so these would probably be the heats of that competition. And I do recall that with Scott Maddison was... What happens if you're on a big gig... You psych yourself up, especially if you're not an advanced musician. I mean, none of us were advanced musicians. So, like, everybody's slightly arrogant, actually. Mm. And I remember Scott Maddison on this one, he was having a lot of, no, we're going to win this, and that, you know. And, of course, the first thing that happened when he went on, he picked up the microphone, and the band were playing quite well, you know. I think they were doing 5 foot 2, where they play an intro, which had been a minor hit for Shane Fenton or Alvin Stardust, as he became. I remember picking the microphone and going, and nothing came out. So he hadn't switched his, you know, he was that nervous. He either hadn't switched his microphone on or something wasn't working, because we all laughed. Because all the bands were in watching this, and he was a big head, you know. I mean, it was just... But he was a good guy. And so we all got a good laugh out of that one. The Barons, I'm still in touch with Roddy Omans. He's still around. Let's have a look. Here we go. Thursday the 14th of February. We played at Skyline in contests. So those, yes, they were contests. Lost. We lost that heat. And it was the night after I'd been to see the Beatles. Can you believe that? That was at the Majestic.
It sounds like it was a very... busy time, and there was a lot going on in terms of the...
Well, in 1963, I was 19 years old. You know, I mean, I don't know how old you are, but, I mean, what were you doing at 19? I mean, it's a busy time for everybody, isn't it? We're out...
What I mean is there seems to be a lot of venues that you could go to.
Cross Keys, that was in Beverley. Nafferton Village Hall. Went to Bridge to see Mike... that was a night school. So, like, the Beatles were at the Majestic... on the Wednesday the 13th of February, 63. On Sunday, I mean, so if I wasn't playing, I was out watching. Majestic on the Sunday of that week, I went to see the Aces, and Johnny Orr had left, who was the singer. So that's when they probably got Eric Lee in. Let's have a look. There's a lot happening at Cross Keys there. Moorends Hotel. Now, the Moorends Hotel... I'm digressing, sorry, so edit this out. Moorends Hotel is at Thorn. And it used to call it Uncle Arthur's. And they had top liners in there. You cannot believe it. A pub in a dead-end village, a mining village, with top liners. And, I mean, people like the Baronites, again, Shane Fenton, the Fentons, Dave Berry and the Cruisers, Freddie and the Dreamers go there. We went down O'Kern. We got £7 for that, which is... 140 quid today. Let's go through this. It's a bit of a bad period there by the look of things. Elizabethan Hall, that was a school on Greatfield. Cross Keys, there's another Skyline somewhere up here. There it is. So, although we lost the last heat on Wednesday the 13th of March, we were at the Skyline again, and we won the heat. So we obviously went into a, it wasn't a knockout, it was a, you know, a second best thing. We won heat against four other groups. Somewhere there are photographs of that. I know because I saw them because I went the next week, or I did, or they were showing photographs from the, our previous visit. So somewhere there are photographs of that. Let's have a look. Skyline again. We lost the heat. My comment on Thursday the 21st of March 1963. Skyline lost heat. Went on first, fiddled result. No, well, of course it wasn't, but, you know, kids, it's always a fiddled result, isn't it? We just weren't good enough. We played at Skyline again on March the 28th, Thursday. Played at Skyline. All other groups, terrible. We were on four. And we got 15 quid for that. Well, 15 quid, that's 300 quid now, or at least, you know. So it was well worth doing.
So at this point in time, were you, was music like a full-time thing, or did you have kind of other
work?
No,
I had a day job as well. I worked at my father had an engineering company on Holdenhurst Road called United Brass and Copper Works, which it was lining me up to take over, but I just knew I would never get there. I mean, I was working in it, but I didn't want it, even though I could have it for nothing, you know, a good little business. I wanted this, and of course there's a reckoning point at some point in time where you're going to say, I just don't want this, I want that, but that was about 10 years away from this. So like when you think what we were doing, I was having to start at 7:30 in the morning, work through until 5:30, then I would rush home, have my tea, and then clean myself up, change, and I'd be off on a gig somewhere, generally speaking. I mean, if it was in Hull or Beverley, I mean, there's Memorial Hall, Beverley there. Skyline again. Look, on Saturday the 13th of April. Two spots, great night. Two spots, 20 minutes and 10 minutes. So we only played half an hour. But we only got £6.10 for that. £6.50.
I don't think you've mentioned what your group was called, or was it more than one group?
No, sorry, yes, I forgot. Yeah, at that time we were called the Sunsets, which were just a quartet, guitar, bass, drums, and singer. That was it. I mean, we were different because most groups, I'll call them groups because that's what we call them, bands in those days, had what they call a rhythm guitarist who probably sang a bit as well. But we liked Johnny Kidd and the Pirates, who had the same lineup as us, so we more or less copied some of the way that they would do things. And it worked very well, but I mean, when it fell to the ground a bit was when you were playing Shadows instrumentals, where they did have a rhythm guitar to fill it out. But I had to fill it out. So I had to play things slightly differently, which was good, you know, because I think it made me a better player. And we also chose... It was the age of the big instrumental then, you know, 1962, 63. So we were always looking for different tunes to play, but beaty tunes and that could be quite spectacular, you know.
So was your band, and were most of the bands at this point covers bands, or were bands doing original material?
Oh, no, we're
material?
All covers band. Nobody did their own stuff. You'd have got booed off. No, it didn't work in those days. You had to go and do somebody else's, somebody else. Right. So here we are. Look, practice Wednesday, the 10th of April. Practice. Honey, don't. That was a what do you call him? A Carl Perkins. I still do that. Funny enough, and it's a great song. Cherished Memories, which was a Eddie Cochran song. Why we did that? I've no idea. So they were slightly unusual. If you went to see a band, they generally did the same sort of stuff, which we did. You have to. There were popular songs that you had to do everywhere you played, but you would slip in things that you wanted to do occasionally, which is what this was all about. Because that said two things. It says you've done a bit of research, and you're actually better than the other guys. which we weren't, but you thought you were. Yeah, so, oh God, and so it goes on. I think, yeah. So I mean, just turning the pages on this diary again. I mean, I'm going away from the skyline again. Bridlington, Tully's Ballroom, which was down off Fountain Road somewhere, I think. Cross Keys was Beverly. We got residences, you know. Right, is it? I mean, here we are. So Thursday, April the 25th, practiced, got off Golden Earrings. That's a... It's a tune. So it's like a Shadows thing. But it was done by... Doesn't matter, does it? It's and we got off Chains, which was an American song, but the Beatles covered it, and we covered that. So just by going off a little bit, we thought we were being superior. But the thing you've got to remember is it's all right playing the 1812 Overture on guitar. If you can't dance to it, nobody wants to know. So there had to be songs that people could move to.
So this at this point, it was all about dancing in one way or another. That was what the bands were there for, to allow people to dance.
Or if you're in a club, it had to be good to listen to. You know, I mean, one of the things I used to do, and a lot of people did this, we did a show song and I would put the guitar behind my head and go, you know, make a noise. And, oh, isn't he good? Yeah, no, he's not. He's awful. You know? But he's got away with it. Yeah, so we're all the time we were looking for different things to do and different places to play. And as the year goes on, as you can see, it then becomes horrendous. Skyline, here we are, November. Friday the 8th of November, 1963. Skyline Ballroom, £6.10 we got. That's for the whole band. Whole Prince's dance. Whole Prince's were based in Willoughby. Not particularly brilliant. So I always put a little comment in. I think that was the last time we played. That was the last time we played there, I think, before 1967. What happened in 1965, I became so busy. We'd organised things, so I got a worksheet, which I've still got of some of them. But it wasn't as handy as this little diary. And we were just all over the place, you know, all over the country, really. And we were on with people like the Rolling Stones and Peter and Gordon, Marty Wilde. And we started to back a Scottish duo called the McKinley Sisters, who were two girls who sang. So it opened loads of doors for us.
It must have been a tremendously exciting time.
Well, you can understand that. So if I'm in a boiler suit, stood at a lathe for like 8 or 9 hours a day, and in Windsor I see 1 hour of daylight when I go out for my lunch. As a young person, I mean, the other thing you've got to remember is I just spent like 4 years at a boarding school, locked up. I was bursting out. I just wanted to get out, and I wanted to have some fun, quite honestly. So that's what happened. And although we never actually turned professional with any of these bands, I never actually relied on it until about 1972 or 3 or something, I think, when I'd got things together, so I was competent enough to handle most situations. But yeah, I mean, and we're all the same, everybody. I mean, like the whole Prince's dance, the reason we got that is our bass player worked at Old Prince's, and then the singer was a hairdresser, and the drummer, he was a printer as well, and he was at Harlan's, I think, which was in Anderby. So we all had day jobs, and then of course, you know, we all just went home, and then we had a group van, and we just go and pick everybody up, which in itself is a pain. But don't forget, there was not the traffic then that there is now, so we could get around Hull quite quickly.
So this kind of relates a little bit back to the Skyline Ballroom, but it's a question as well about the kind of music scene at the time. I'm interested in this sort of division between, or is there a division between, the kind of slightly more old-fashioned ballroom dancing kind of setup, and then you've got kind of more modern pop groups doing gigs, as maybe we'd think of them more today. And both of them things were kind of happening at the same time in the same venues. Is that right?
That's correct. What was happening is ballroom was dying. Because you needed, you didn't actually need, but because it was perceived that you need a big band to play successful ballroom music, it was becoming too expensive. So if you could get a pop group with four or five people in who would pay for a tenner, then why play a big band 50 quid or whatever it costs in those days? Because you would have maybe 10, 15, 20 people in a big band. I mean, I played in some small big bands, what we called small big bands, which were a rhythm section with trumpet and sax and maybe something else. And they sort of survived a bit in hotels and places like that. But generally, the ballrooms, I mean, even the Majestic, when I first went there, which was 61, 62, had a big band with Leon Riley singing, who was a local singer, was actually very good. He should have gone a lot further than he did. So there were all these big bands, and all the people like Norman Mail had a big band, and then there was Norris Walker had a big band. So you could hire these people. And actually what you were doing, you were hiring the same people. You were just standing somebody else at the front waving a stick. So I mean, there was for blowing musicians, I mean, trumpets and saxophones and things, it was a good time, you know, they could all get work. Now it's a little bit more difficult because nobody wants it. You know, they just want to press a button and what comes out, comes out.
So when kind of Skyline opened, was there a feeling that that was a ballroom venue, or was it a venue for kind of groups, or was it kind of neither?
Well, it was anything that opened that had entertainment, that sort of entertainment, was always viewed on as an opportunity to get yourself in there and see if you can get yourself a gig, you know. Sometimes it worked, sometimes it didn't. But it was an optimistic time when that opened, because, as I said before, it was an opportunity, another opportunity, another ballroom, another place where we could work, where we could hone our craft and go on to whatever we went on to. You know, like Mick Ronson went on with Bowie. And, I mean, funnily enough, one of the photographs on that CD I've given you is the Batman, and you probably won't recognise him, but the guy at the front is Rick Kemp, who went on to play bass with Steel Eye Span. So there are people from Hull who made it quite big, in a way. I didn't, but I did have opportunities to do that. I was approached by Jimmy Powell and the Five Dimensions, who were a group from Birmingham, and their harmonica player was Rod Stewart. But I didn't like them because I didn't think he could sing very well, you know. I was approached by a band called Heatwave. I don't know if you remember Boogie Nights, all that. Rod Temperton was from this area. So I was involved in the recording of that first LP. And the guitar player was leaving, and Rod asked me to join. And I said no. Although I liked the music, I just didn't think I could handle it, really. It was personality was difficult with some of the people in it. But what a band, you know. So another missed opportunity. Let's get back to the Skyline, shall we? Right.
So you mentioned there was kind of a bit of a gap there, maybe till 67 when you played again.
So there it is. Yeah. I only recall doing this one gig in the Skyline. There were lots of, I mean, there were people like, do you remember Robert Palmer? Addicted to Love. I mean, I had a hit with him, and he was living in Scarborough. It was called Alan Palmer in those days, and he was on with somebody like, let's say, Jimi Hendrix. So like local bands like the Strollers from Beverly, they would maybe on with The Move. So the good thing about it was, and this is where we scored, because we travelled more than anybody else, was that you could find yourself working with some top liners. But the other good thing is, of course, is places like the Skyline put on a full show, so you'd get Jimi Hendrix at the top, maybe three or four other local bands, or a semi-name band, or as in the case with Traffic here, you know, we would Traffic with Stevie Winwood and Jim Capaldi and all that. Then Chris Farlow, they had Albert Lee. I had the pleasure of Albert Lee watching me, you know. Fortunately, I didn't know it was him, and I was actually playing rather well. Mike Cotton, he was a jazz band. He started out, and then he decided that because traditional jazz was dying off a bit, like the dance bands, he would move into the blues. So that's what he did. So there was a full night of varied entertainment. Same thing happened at universities, you know. That's why we ended up playing with the Move in Sheffield and the Merseybeats and people like that. So they were able to afford it. And I mean, like, it was maybe 10 bob to go in, 50p, which, when you think, let's go back to now. In 1963, I mean, I remember when I started work in 1960, I was on £3.10, that's £3.50. Now, that might not sound like a lot of money, but you could get drunk for a quid. You know, you would get 10 pints of some beer or other, so you could fall over for a pound. Not that I did that, but... So that's the purchasing power of the money in those days. So about 1963, I'd be on about 6 or 7 quid a week, plus whatever I was earning here. So I was doing all right, which was good. And I had a company car as well, which is another good thing. So I got to run a lot of the gear about before we got a group band, you know. Yeah, so...
So how did the Skyline change over the years? You mentioned this period of kind of playing there a fair bit in kind of 63 and then a bit of a gap. Did you notice any kind of change when you
What happened? I mean, like it was a taste, the change was the taste of the people of the country. So we'd gone from standard ballrooms, so then we introduced the little groups to fill the gap when the band were off, because although they would play records, we didn't really have discos like we have now. You would have people who would play record, you could have disc jockeys, you know, but it wasn't quite the same. The accent was on live music. So then it moved from, so when they got rid of the Skyliners, the original resident band, so then it moved into bringing in the Hendrixes and all those sort of people, and then that fizzled out about, well, late 60s, and that's when it became Bailey's and places, you know, that sort of thing, because there was a cabaret club scene was becoming big. I mean, I do remember I did actually play one night in the cabaret band because their guitar player was ill or something, and I got lumbered, and I can't remember who I was on with. We just had to play them on, that was all. So you know, and that's it. And then you go and watch the act, and then you've got to make sure that the cue comes off the guy who's on stage that says, "I've had enough." Can he come back? So then you go back on, and then he gives you another cue, and you play him off, and that's it. So that was with, I remember the lady singer was Helen Day, and Dave Sanders was on bass. So this is probably early 70s, I would think. So what happened in the early 70s, as far as I'm concerned, I moved into Clubland. I went to the Rex Club at Driffield, and then I went to the Telstar Club in Bransome, which had just opened, so we were the new band in there. And then my next encounter with the Skyline was when it became Romeo's. So can you see the cabaret clubs were dying off, but the disco clubs were coming in. So I put together a disco band and called Quincy, after Quincy Jones. And that's when I got the 2 years there. And again, occasionally they put acts on, like Vernon Manning, who was actually a very nice man, funnily enough, although he came over as a monster. And we just, again, it was mostly playing people on and off, although Bernard did sing. But we had some good readers in the band, so we just played, you know, they would come with the sheets of music and say, play that. And you maybe, if you were lucky, you'd get a run through. If you didn't, you just played it. And of course, that way, you occasionally get mistakes. It was either too fast, too slow, or whatever. But yeah, so that was a good time, the Romeo Disco thing. Of course, the whole layout changed, because the beer garden then was not accessible to the audience, it was accessible to us. So it became just that unit at the top. And where they had this frame, this wooden frame, rather like this suspended ceiling, they filled it in with foil, metallic foil, so it reflected. And they hung all the speakers and everything off this huge frame. And a couple of balloon containers and just lights and things, you know, that it was the beginning of disco, really, was that. And it was a very good venue. And again, you know, you had to go up in the lift. Although the stairs were accessible, they didn't really want you to use. I think there'd been an accident. I can't quite remember. I don't know if it was this one, but somebody fell and they either were killed or... So they stopped people using the stairways, only in emergencies. But yeah, they were good times. And I'm just trying to think that all these they had all these reflective surfaces. They had, like, because we're so used to stage lighting as it is today, we can't imagine what it was like before that. And it was a cross between theatre lights and just odd coloured lights. So what they did is they had huge tiles which had designs on them that reflected light. They were reflective. They were foil or something. And as you moved, they moved. You'll have seen them if you see them. But yeah, it was good. And we had a manager who held court. He was a bit of a strange person, really. Totally the wrong man for the job. But
is this the manager at Romeo's?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
In what sense was he the wrong man for the job?
Well, it was actually a crook. He used to run raffles and things that nobody in the audience won. So then what happened with the prize was then it would go into storage and it would come up again maybe 6 months later. It did actually go to jail in the end. Sorry about that. But I had to pay him a bribe a week to keep my job going, you know. So that's the sort of person he was. And he would hold court in his office and everybody would pander to him. But he was not very pleasant. And he was violent as well. So it was... But I'd seen this before. And the reason I'd seen this before is before I went to Romeo's, I was at the Hofbrauhaus House, which was down George Street. And that burnt down in suspicious circumstances. And evidently, the people who owned it were twins. They weren't the Crays, but they were from Leeds. And that's what they did. If the venue didn't... I mean, it was regular. If the venue didn't play, they burnt it down and hoped to get the insurance, you know. That's the nasty side of it. Careful. I'm just committing myself to... Although the guy's now dead anyway, so it didn't really matter. And I haven't named him.
So I can't kind of read these on to another question, kind of vaguely. You've talked a bit about the kind of club and the decor of the place. That changed a little bit. How did the sort of the scene and the people coming in the club, did they sort of change, or was it the same kind?
Well, as people with new things, there's an amount of trepidation, isn't there? You know, if you go into a new venue, you're looking around and you don't quite know how to behave. But by the time we got to Romeo's, we were in advanced club audience. They knew what to do, they knew what they were there for, and they got on with it. Funnily enough, there was very little violence at there was one incident that I'm seeing. This is ridiculous. This is probably about 1968, because I was with the Key Third Band, and there was a fight broke out, and it was when they let the balloons down. This fight broke out, and sort of like these people beating each other up, and one poor chap was just laid out, you know. So they had to call an ambulance, and the police were called. And what happened is, so up they came, and they put this man on a stretcher, and they arrested this chap for grievous bodily harm or something. And I remember I was in the lift as they were going down with this guy on the stretcher, and this bloke was in cuffs with these two policemen. And the copper said to him, "Why did you do that? What on earth, you know, what possessed you to do that?" And he just turned to him and he said, "Well, he burst my balloon." You know, so that's, you just think, what? He's nearly killed somebody because he burst a balloon, and that was the idea. It was a bit of fun, but he couldn't take the fun, you know. So there was a bit of that, but not an awful lot. Not as much as other places, you know. Most places had bouncers.
So the kind of skyline Baileys, Romeo's, was,
yeah.
You say not as much as other places. So it was seen as a fairly kind of like safe and,
yes,
and nice, yeah, club. Would that be fair to say?
Yeah. It did have its rough elements, of course, but I didn't see that. I certainly didn't see it with Romeo's. There would be incidents, but I was working, so I was looking into lights. So if it didn't happen at the front of the stage in front of me, I didn't see it because I was doing so, and I was reading music or whatever I was doing, or I was singing or whatever. There was a lot going on. So unless it was a big, what they call a big rumble in those days, you didn't realise that things were going on, and the ballroom orderlies would sort it. You know, they would eject people and say, don't come back, you know. And sure enough, next week they were back, you know. another incident that happened in Romeo's, I remember this. I had a pedal board in front of my guitar. In fact, I was on bass, so it was anyhow, there were pedals. And I came back off my break and missing. Somebody pinched one of my American pedals. And I thought, oh, damn, you know. And then a little bit later into the set, the alarm went off. And we had to clear the ballroom. So what's going on? Because it was the time of the Irish thing. And they discovered a suspicious package under one of the... So I'm on stage here and over there, across the way where the seats were, under there was a suspicious package, which actually was my pedal, but they didn't know that because it was in a metal thing with a button on top, so it looked for all intents and purposes like a detonator. So we got away with a cheap night. You know, we got a full night's pay for not playing that night because they had to clear the ballroom. The police came in and cleared everywhere, and they interviewed us. And they said, well, "Do you know what this is?" I said, "Oh yeah, that's my pedal." You know, so I said to him, "I just noticed that somebody pinched it." More or less, when all hell let loose, you know. But actually, thinking about it, that was a good move, really, because at least you know that they were on the ball. Whenever anything like that happens, you think, oh, dash, I don't want to go out, you know, but then you've got to do it because it might just be what they think it was. So, yeah, the memories come flooding back, don't they? You forget all this, and then when you start talking about it, it all sort of come back a bit.
You've talked about a couple of kind of incidents there, but are there any particular nights that stand out for you, favourite nights or particularly memorable nights?
One night we had Ben and Manning for two or three nights, and there was an American ship in Hull Docks, so in come all the GIs, and Bernard comes on, and of course they're not listening, all the Americans are interested in is the women, and he comes on and he starts his act, and he says, right, he said, that's it, folks. He said, I can see I'm not making any impression with you. He said, you're more interested in the women than you are with me, and I can understand why. See you tomorrow. And I put the mic up and we played him off. So he was on for 5 minutes. And he went to the manager and said, look, he said, wrong night. He said, it happens. Don't pay me. I'll see you tomorrow. So the professionalism of that man, he realised that he had no chance of scoring with that audience. But one night where it was absolutely fantastic, Dave Lee Travis, the disc jockey, came up, and he appeared on into the disc jockey. So like the stage was here, and to my right would be the disc jockey tables and everything. And Dave Lee Travis brought a disc jockey with him. He stood at the front doing things and doing all the talking, and this guy cued everything in. But he wandered onto the stage dressed as Darth Vader. You know, but because he's very, very tall. And like, it was just incredible the way they did it. They'd got the dry ice and everything, you know. So there was all fog and mist, and they had the cape and the hat, you know, the big helmet. And that was magic. You know, it just worked 100%. They'd got them straight away. Because they played the right music to get him on, you know, the Star Wars thing. And if he comes, you know, through all this mist and everything, and everybody's going, well, it's Darth Vader. So that was a good night. They had Tony Blackburn there, although, funny enough, that was the week I went to New York for a week. We were allowed holidays. We used to get guest DJs who would, in between when we were playing, or we were playing between when they were playing, depending on how you look at it. So it was a terrific place. There's more went on there than what people imagine. Even I'm sort of quite amazed, really, when I read my diaries and things, just how much went on. It's brilliant. Yeah, shame it's going, isn't it?
So when did you kind of stop regularly playing or going to, was you there when that club actually shut, Romeo's, or did you kind of stop?
No, what happened after, I did two seasons at Romeo's, and I finished in 1980, 79, 80. So then in 81, 82, I moved off to a place called Lambeth Hall, which is on Sutton Park. And we were working with people like Gene Pitney, Lulu, Brotherhood of Man, from the top of my head. Every week there was an act, Peters and Lee, all these sort of people. And that was brilliant. That was another one, really, but it was just the way. There's always you know, like something that doesn't quite work. I mean, the first thing that happened at Lambeth Hall is they built the stage across the corner of the room. And because the guy who owned it had been to Las Vegas and seen how they did it, but what he didn't see is all the electronics to get the sound to all the people who stood like 10 feet in the air. So we get Ken Goodwin the first week, opening night. We can't hear him. You know, he stood with a dot in the distance, and we couldn't back him. So, well, we did actually in the end, but we had to move everything around very rapidly. Another thing he wanted to do, where the artist came on at the corner of each stage, he wanted to put a door. Well, I mean, can you imagine saying, and here's Lulu, and you open the door and she walks on, you know. I mean, he didn't think of slash curtaining where you could sort of make an entrance. There were just lots and lots of little things that we got right in the end. But, oh, gosh, it was difficult with that. But they didn't have that at Skyline. I mean, obviously, they will have had the TV troubles, like with the floor, when they had to tighten those springs up on the floor and things to stop people falling over. But then some of the major faults in, I mean, Jackson's Ballroom, I remember I was applied for the job there, and I was talking to the guy for a couple of hours, you know, and he said, dressing room wise, what do you recommend? I said, well, I said, funnily enough, I said, the main thing is you've got to have an artist toilet. I said, because when you're going on a stage, you're a little bit, I'll use the word, frightened, and it makes you want to go. And if you've got to go into the audience and to the toilet, same as everybody else in your pantomime dame outfit or whatever you're wearing, it looks a bit stupid. And of course, they never put it in. Can't believe it. There was space, but they never put it in, never listened. So all sorts of things that that they got wrong. I mean, so big stars had to go at Jackson's, they had to, and the way from the dressing room, from what I can remember, came through the squash courts, and it was a heck of a trek, you know. And then you're into a public area, and you might be Elvis, you know. They just don't understand. But fortunately, at the Skyline, they'd done their own work, you know. They'd got that right. Yeah. Oh my gosh. Fun and games. I don't know. Of course, after Lambeth Hall, I went to Churchill's, or the Burcombe Country Club at Preston. That was, I mean, that was completely private. the guy who owned it was a joiner, and the dressing rooms was a dive for. They even had a shower in there, you know, and toilets and washing facilities, warm room, carpeted settees. You know, most dressing rooms were just old chairs that had broken in the ballroom, you know, and the odd mirror about, and it was cold. We used to call them a dressing fridge. Oh, yeah.
Did you have any particular favourite nights as a punter at Skyliner Romeo's, or were you mainly there working?
I was mainly there working with all this, because I rely, by this, you know, time I was starting to rely on it as an income. I had to put it first. So yes, I did have nights out where I went to see people. But they had Marvin Welsh and Farrett when Bailey's were on at the Skyline, and I'd love to have seen them, you know, but I couldn't because I had gigs. So I missed a lot of it. I only saw what was on with me, which in itself was quite considerable, you know, quite a lot of the time. But the only one I did see, which I remember, was the Eric Clapton one with John Miles Blues Brokers. But who else was on, I can't remember. I was probably in the beer garden getting drunk.
So what sort of things would you drink, and was alcohol kind of a big part of a night out at this point? Or?
No, not really. No, I do recall, so just digressing a little, I do recall I'd seen pop bands, well, even like the Rolling Stones. I mean, when I worked with them, I thought, ooh, French cigarettes, you know, how naive can you get? It wasn't French cigarettes at all, it was something else. But I had seen that quite a few jazz musicians and advanced pop musicians relied on alcohol. So I thought, well, maybe that's the way. So one night at Cleethorpes, the Lifeboat Hotel, I thought, right, this is it, you know, rum and coke. And I got absolutely drunk, you know. I actually fell off the stage, and I damaged a very nice coat I had, and that was it. I never did it ever again. After that, it was watered down beer, you know, shandies or something that didn't affect me, because once it works for some people, alcohol never works for me. All it does is it makes me miserable because I'm fighting the effects. But for Charlie over there, it's absolutely fabulous. He's drunk and enjoying himself, you know, but it didn't work for me. So when I go on, I've got to be stone cold sober because I've got to make my brain work. Especially what I do now, which is a lot of busking stuff. People will shout a song and I've got to play it. I've got to remember it. So alcohol didn't play a lot of part in my life after that. Although, you know, yeah, I would have a pint maybe. But it didn't work for me.
What about the kind of audiences? Do you think people going out to kind of get drunk a lot at that point? Or you talked about the kind of the French cigarettes, was the stuff like that going on, do you think? Or was you unaware? Or
with the French cigarettes, I mean, I was unaware. I always remember my mother saying to me once, if somebody offers you a reefer, say no. And I didn't know what she was talking about, you know, which was obviously marijuana. But she knew about it. So why did she know about it? You know, but I didn't. So, eventually you get to know the smells of these things. And I hated it, actually. Just to digress, I always remember I did a gig at the Spa Theatre in Bridlington, not the ballroom, the theatre. And it involved me playing El Comanchero, which is just a ding, 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 and then there's a run, and it's done fast and an offbeat, you know, very fast. And two members of the band were smoking pot. Unfortunately, they're both dead now. But and I thought, oh, I hate this because the pungent smell. And so myself and the keyboard player, the keyboard player smoked cigarettes, but he didn't smoke pot. But the other two were smoking this stuff. Well, it came to the performance, and I went, I couldn't play. I'd gone. I'd passively smoked this stuff. And so I got there. And then I looked at me, because there was a time shift. I don't know whether you ever smoked this stuff. But there's like a time shift where everything goes into slow motion. And I couldn't play. My fingers were like rubber. You know, I remember looking and thinking, I can't play this. Fortunately, the keyboard player had ingested less of this stuff than I, and he played it for me. But, you know, it was absolutely dreadful. It just didn't work for me. Yeah, I know. I knew people who were having this stuff for breakfast. Oh, dear. Yeah, so the alcohol drugs, I never met anybody on hard drugs, what I call, you know, injecting. I mean, they may have been there, but I didn't see them. Never. The only closest I got was a friend of mine who was a diabetic, and I remember being in a restaurant, and he said, oh, well, I've got to do it. And he injected himself with insulin. And I thought, bloody hell, you know. And the waiter saw it, and he thought he was doing heroin, you know. I thought, you might have gone to the toilet and done it. But it really was insulin. I mean, I know it was because I know the guy. I still know the guy. Yeah, so there were, that side was a bit strange. Yeah.
What sort of things would you wear, and would the audience wear? I mean, obviously we're talking about, it's over a time period here, so yeah. Kind of from the 60s to the kind of like 70s, early 80s, but how did your fashion and the fashions of the audience kind of shift over that point on a night out?
Well, of course, if you're in a band and you've got a band uniform, then I mean our first the Sunsets uniform, and this was a total no-no, really. We had bright red trousers, white shoes, white shirts, and big white knitted sweaters with a red S on. Now that sounds good, it looked great in a photograph. If you're playing it in a hot club and you're melting, you know. Fortunately for me, when I joined the Sunsets, I inherited, are we okay?
Yep.
I inherited a pair of trousers from a chap who was same height as me but slightly thinner. I always remember at the Gondola Club bending down to switch my echo unit on, and I gave the audience a big smile from the back as the scene went, you know, oh my god, you know. So I had to actually play with my back to be amplified. Although I had my underwear on, of course, but still embarrassing, you know. And so then what happened is we all went out and bought what we call shotted silk suits. They were a shiny Italian suit with three buttons, had a nice tie and a nice shirt with a pin collar on. I mean, we all had lovely hair, you know, and all that rubbish. Nice shoes. And then what happened, we were taken as that band. The Sunsets became the Mods. We got a new singer and a new drummer. And we were taken on by an agency, and they've kitted us out with one-piece suits. So they were like a waistcoat and a pair of jeans, but they were joined. So, it was like a boiler suit without the arms in, really, but a little bit more stylish, and paisley shirts, which was a little bit more advanced than what the audience were wearing. They generally turned up in casual gear. It wasn't all jeans in those days. You know, people would wear cavalry swells and what they call lounge gear in those days. It was very different to what it is now. They were smarter. On a Saturday night, they would dress up. Then after that, it started to go into, what did we do? We got jackets, more jackets. So that, because we were doing dinner dances and things and dicky bow ties. And then when we went to Romeo's, we went to a place called Stagewearing Limited, which was in Goldthorpe near Mexborough somewhere. And they specialised in stage gear. And we all bought individual outfits. You know, I mean, I had a pair of blue flare trousers and a very nice, not tiger skin, but some animal skin. It was a print. Top, and so we were all individually dressed, which is the way it all went with the disco thing. Everybody wore what the groovy stage wear, you know. And then eventually, of course, it all turned into what we're all wearing now, which is, if I play in a band, I've got black trousers, black shirt, which are the worst colours for a stage because I can't see you. But generally, I'm not stood at the front of a stage. I am supporting somebody else. So the focus of attention is the guy in the middle, who's probably wearing something different. So as a backing musician, I am at the back in black.
So you mentioned kind of the audiences early on there wearing, not really kind of wearing jeans and things,
yeah,
kind of relatively smart clothing to what we think of today. How did you see the audience's kind of fashion change from that kind of 60s to sort of late 70s?
Well, as generally, as the quality of the clothes seems to deteriorate, really, in my mind anyway. So like, yes, you would go to a what I call a ball in a ballroom, a private, let's say, and everybody would be in dinner suits. But if you went to a public dance, I mean, there were restrictions. You couldn't go into Tiffany's without a tie on. So you had to have a tie, and they wouldn't let you in with jeans. So you had to have casual trousers. But eventually, as with all things, the public really do dictate what happens. They all want to wear jeans, and you've got an empty ballroom and 4 million people in jeans, you say, come on in, don't you?
So did Skyline Bailey's Romeos have any kind of dress codes?
But yes, they would do at first. I can't actually remember that, but generally, if you were going to a ballroom, you dressed up in a jacket and tie and trousers. It didn't have to be a suit, but it had to be smart. And you polished your shoes. You wouldn't go dancing in trainers, you know, because nobody had them. They were sand shoes in our day. You got them from Boys for like £5 or something. You can't believe what you're paying for them now. So you would be denied access if you weren't reasonably smartly dressed. That still happens occasionally in hotel gigs. They recommend that you dress smart, and if you don't put a tie on, put a jacket on. I mean that still happens in various places, but not very often now. You know, they're just there for the money, really. But the audience, yeah. I mean, I remember I was singer in the Mods, Rod, or Tony Martin as he was known. He got a pair of jeans and he frayed the bottoms. I mean, they're still doing that. I mean, so like it's so old hat to me. This was 55 years ago. He was fraying his jeans, you know. And I thought, oh, what have you done that for? You know, oh, it's good, yeah, you know. It's in, you know. What? Because he was a bit of a dandy, was Rod. He would always dress up, and he wouldn't dress the same as us. So he always had a different... So we had a band outfit, and he would stand at the front singing and be dressed differently. Because that's what he wanted to do, you know. And it worked to a certain extent. We pulled certain stunts on him which I can't tell you about, but he was unaware of. But we got our own back on him. Yeah. I mean, actually, one of the things that just going back to the violence in ballrooms, although I never saw it very much in the Skyline, Majestic down Witham suffered with that quite a lot. There'll be scraps breaking out, you know, and in fact that's probably what closed it down in the end. And I do remember going to Bridge Spa, and there was a whole gang called the Limbo Gang, and all they wanted to do was go in the ballroom and beat people up. So they would go, they went en masse to Bridlington and just took on all the Brid kids, you know, and there was this big scrap going on, and there's somebody like the Nashville Teams playing away, and there was all this fighting going on. I saw that, but I was on the balcony after. I'm not going down there. I avoid violence like the plague. It didn't. That's something else that didn't work for me. You know, I'm the fastest runner on the pitch. You know? I'm going to kill you. No, you know, you can't fast me. You know? So you know, I mean, it's all human behaviour, isn't it? you know, what is popular with clothes they wear, and if it's popular beating people, they will do that. Strange, but it was an era that will never be repeated, because we tend to forget that 1963 was only, it wasn't long after the end of the world. It was only 18 years, wasn't it? You know, and when you're the age that I am now, I mean, that's just back to the millennium, you know. And I can tell you what I was doing. I was away for that, you know. So it's not that long, and because we'd been constricted, and before the war, of course, it was different. It was a completely different. I mean, there were, if you went in the country, you saw more or less peasants, farm workers. They were peasants, you know. I mean, I don't mean that in a derogatory sense, but they didn't have very much. They lived in cottages. They didn't have televisions. They might have had a radio. So entertainment was pushing forward all through this, and it was an arrow going forward, saying, and getting bigger and bigger as it spread its tentacles, you know. So people, it was new to people in this country, although in America they'd had it for a while, because they didn't have, although they were involved in the Second World War, it wasn't on home ground, so they could continue doing what they did. So we lagged behind everybody else. Everybody seemed to recover from the war before we did, although by the 60s we'd started to lead the world again in pop music, which was great, and I was part of it in a very small way.
Looking back, how do you sort of remember that era, and specifically like the kind of the skyline sort of ballroom, how did that sort of fit in that world? Do you remember that kind of place fondly?
Yeah, I do indeed, because I had that residency there, so I did 2 years there. But also the other little gigs that I did there, and it was always there. But unless I was working there, as you see in my diary, I mean, yes, I did pay visits early in 63, because I hadn't got the Sunsets going by then. But by the end of 63. My visits, it was to do a gig. There's nowhere listed where I went there to actually enjoy a night out. Funny enough, I do recall a friend of mine, Mike Tyson, not the boxer. I had a friend of Stratocaster that I got rid of, and he ended up with it. And I remember him coming into Hammond's, because Hammond's, or House of Fraser, used to sell musical instruments on the top floor. And he came in with the neck of the Strat that I had, Fender Stratocaster. And I said, "What are you doing, Mike? What have you done that for?" He said, "I'm going to see Hendrix tonight, and I'm going to get him to sand the back of the headstock." Nobody did that. Nobody did that in those days. So that was a first, where you actually got a star to sign your instrument. Whether or not he actually did it, I don't know. Because I was playing on that night somewhere else. You know, I was probably in some pokey pub down Chumley Street or something. it was just a fantastic era that can never ever be repeated, because the circumstances that caused it will never happen again. You know, I mean, it might happen in some other aspect of life, but I don't think so with music. Although, to be honest, it is ready for a change, is music, to my ears. Can't stand it, you know. It's really weird. I can usually get something out of song. I mean, I was watching Rod Stewart on Sunday night on television, and I'd sort of seen Rod. I'd seen him at Gondola, and he's done some good stuff, but the song he sang on Saturday night or Sunday night was awful. I just thought, God, that's awful. There's no tune to it. So what's happened is, you've probably realised, I am an old man. And I have become my father. In fact, I've become my grandfather. That's the way it is, isn't it? You know, like, how many... You probably didn't happen to you. You know, turn that row off, it's chewless junk. You know, can't understand the words. Well, I'm there. That's it.
So just before we finish up, I wondered if you had... Because obviously we've talked largely about the clubs and the kind of music scene, because that's something you're heavily involved in. Do you have any particular memories of the rest of the co-op building and the department store there?
Well, I do actually, because I mean, they had a record department, and I remember buying a couple of albums, LPs, you know, vinyl. I've still got them. One thing about me is I collect things. I'm a collector. You know, you've probably seen programmes on television about people like me. I've got stuff going back. I've got records going back to 1908, which were my father's. Huge shellac discs, you know. I would occasionally buy things from there. I would occasionally buy records from there. It was never like Hammond's. That was the problem it had, which is probably one of the reasons it failed. And the co-op would do better than Edwin Davis round the corner, because once you start going off the beaten track, people get lazy, don't they? If you're walking down Jameson Street, I'll just nip in there. But if you go around the corner to Savile Street, you probably think, oh, I can't be bothered with that. We'll go to the pub across the road or something, you know. So it's location, really, of these things. But I do think that I'm just sort of remembering when we left. One of the things I used to do, you might think this is rather strange, I used to have a little transistor radio, and I would go onto the police band when I left, because we left by the back door and we were immediately into a very dark area where we could have been attacked if that had been so. So I used to put this small, no bigger than that, transistor radio in my top pocket, and I'd have the police band, you know, and it would make the noise like a police. So they would think it was a policeman and run off. And it worked, because I never got attacked, you know. I just got arrested for listening to the police whip. No, I never did. But, it, you know, so you were aware that there was an element of tension late at night. Because drunk people do that, don't they? You know, they think they're the size of Mount Everest and they're going to crush everybody. Yeah, so... yeah, I'm just trying to think of other things that went on in there. I mean, I do recall we had on Halloween, we did a sketch, and I was supposed to be Dracula, and we'd come up with this thing where I was laid in a coffin actually, and I rose out of it, and we'd got dry ice, fog coming down on the, it was fantastic really. And somebody cuts my hand off with a big chopper that I've made out of plywood and painted it up. And what happens in the end was, so like I have to pick this hand up, which is a rubber hand, and we've filled it full of blood. But it's fake blood, of course. And like with all the lights going on and everything, it just looked like carnage was going on. And then we executed the disc jockey. Well, the disc jockey was a short lad. And we built him up with chicken wire and put a false head on him. So we got the bass cabinet, and we sort of like put him on it, and then the drummer got this chopper that I had and cut his head off, and then his head fell off. And then I remember one saying, "Bloody hell, they've cut his head off!" And then Dougie picks up this head, a false head, of course, because it was in a bucket, and we swung it around, and he slung it up into the air. Well, if you recall earlier, I said there was a frame up there that they put in Baco foil as a reflector. Of course, he went through the Baco foil and came down in the middle of the ballroom. That was fantastic, really. And of course, all the dust that was up there came down with it, so that was funny. And then there was another one where we had to do do you remember the Smurfs? We did a Smurfs thing. We decided that what we would do is sing this silly song, which we'd recorded in the studio. So we were miming to it, and then we'd have a custard pie fight. Well, Julie had made the custard pies, and although she put shaving foam around the outside of the pies, she put real custard on them. And God, the mess was just unbelievable, you know. I mean, it was just mess everywhere, and somebody came up on stage. We were throwing this stuff about at each other, and this woman said, "Give me one, give me one, so... Kevin, this one." And she meant, actually, give me a pie to throw at us. Of course, got one in the face. And the stage was never the same again. We just couldn't get this custard out. So like for the rest of our gig there, which was probably got another couple of 3 months to go before we left, we were sliding about on custard all the time. It was horrendous. What a giggle.